Good afternoon, Judge Graves, Mike Ledney for the Predicted Market. May it please the court. The CFTC violated the Administrative Procedure Act when it ordered the Predicted Market to close. This is the rare administrative law case where the agency does not offer a substantive defense of its decision or a list of ills that will come if the market is permitted to go forward. Instead, the only issue here, this case is solely about whether that decision is insulated from judicial review. The CFTC claims it can greenlight a whole market, set many rules for its operation, and then order it to close and to liquidate the investments of tens of thousands of traders without any obligation to explain itself and without any judicial review. In our view, that claim is wrong and contrary to principles of accountability that are core to the Administrative Procedure Act set forth by Congress to the operation of the administrative state. I want to turn straight and directly to the final agency action issue, which I think is the core issue in this case. We are urging a rule on this court, and it is as follows, and I think if it is applied here, it resolves this case, that when the staff or division of an agency demands the regulated party stop conduct, and the next stop in that matter is an enforcement action if the instruction is not followed, the staff demand is final agency action, and it is subject to judicial review. And I would point the court to the Supreme Court's 2012 decision in the Sackett versus EPA case and the court's 2016 decision in Army Corps of Engineers versus Hawks.
And so your contention is you were a regulated party, regulated by the CFTC?
Absolutely.
Did you have to file reports, annual reports?
There was regular contact between the Division of Market Oversight and my clients about various issues that would come up in the marketplace.
Is that
a
yes or
no? And those continue to today, as it turns out.
That's a yes or a no, you had to file annual reports.
Did we have to file, were we required to file written annual reports? The answer to that question is no.
All right.
Were we provided with inquiries from the agency and did we respond to them on a regular basis? The answer to that question is yes, and often in writing.
All right, you may proceed.
In terms of whether you were regulated or not, the withdrawal of the no action letter specifically says that the contracts, pending contracts, should be closed out no later than midnight Eastern on February 15th, 2023. If that's not being regulated, I don't know what is.
Well, it is awfully specific, Your Honor, and I think that's a very important point to look at here. I want to disaggregate two issues here. I think, with all due respect to Brother Counsel, the CFTC wants to make this case about no action relief writ large and whether no action letters, generally speaking, are subject to judicial review. But the agency action that we are challenging here is that letter on August 4th, 2012. It's CFTC letter 22-08. And that mandate was unambiguous. It lacked any of the qualifications of prior correspondence, such as, well, maybe we're not speaking for the commission here. We might change our mind later. It was a directive.
I was going to go back to your proposed rule. I did not hear in your proposed rule that the staff action could not be, I guess, I don't know if appealed is the wrong word, but in other words, if there's another step within the CFTC, within the agency, you can go and ask, you know, this level of bureaucrat said this staff level, but there's a staff 2.0 level or a whatever, another level that you can go and say, wait a second, you just withdrew the no action letter, you can't do that. Does that need to be part of the rule?
I think it absolutely does, and I probably elided it by saying that the next stop is an enforcement action. So, I mean, I think what is unconceded here, or which is completely undisputed in this case, is that we, the regulated party, had no right to take that mandate and ask somebody else to review it. We could not ask the commission to overturn it. It was the end of the road as far as that mandate goes. The next thing that would happen to us is an enforcement action if we did not close this market at 11:59 p.m. on the 15th of February, and about a week from now before this court's injunction.
Is it open to predict it, to seek, and I'll get the terms wrong, but essentially there are two other ways that markets can operate under the CFTC. One is to be registered, maybe that's the right term, registered. Another one is to get an exemption under 4 or something. Those are two other avenues. Are those open to predict it, to go and, you know, seek those routes to be able to operate?
No, Your Honor, they weren't as a practical matter, and let me explain why. Your typical futures or swaps market would register with the CFTC, and Judge Graves, as you point out, that would entail a variety of even more significant regulatory requirements, that including periodic reporting and many other features of the Commodity Exchange Act. The 2 years prior to our request to open this market, the CFTC, in a formal decision, the so-called NADEX decision, the North American Derivatives Exchange decision, decided that registered markets cannot offer political event contracts, and it referred to a section of the Commodity Exchange Act that said what registered markets can and cannot do, and what the gravamen of that decision, it was really quite specific, is that this type of contract is not for the registered space. So then there's this other option, and you'll find this option in 17 CFR 140.99. This is subsection A. This is the exemption option. And I think if you read the CFTC's brief, there's a little ambiguity on this in the actual regulation in the papers. But that is an avenue that's supposed to pick up on Section 6C of the Commodity Exchange Act. This is at 7 U.S.C. 6C. And 6C authorizes the Commission to exempt certain transactions from many aspects of the Act. But that discretion is not unlimited. And particularly subsection C of that section makes clear that those transactions have to occur between appropriate persons. And the appropriate persons are the type of high net worth individuals or brokers or institutions for whom regulation may not frankly be warranted because they can protect themselves. That's kind of the exact
opposite of what's going on with the predictive market. When Victoria University sought permission to open this market, it wouldn't have done us any good to have great and wealthy making their investments based on their projection of political events. It needed to be a broad base. So it was a small scale market with a limited investment of $850 per contract, limited to 5,000 participants, and trying, just like polls, trying to draw from the widest swath of the American populace. That
couldn't have helped you at least to establish a precedent. This is a market that's exempt from regulation.
Well, it wasn't statutorily available to us because of this restriction on appropriate persons. And this is an argument that we made below, that the CFTC had an opportunity to respond to, and they really haven't disputed that. They haven't said predictive market is the type of market that 6C authority could benefit. It's a very narrow pathway that Congress provided for the CFTC to exempt from.
You don't have a customer that qualifies for this.
Well, I think all of our customers would have to qualify in order to exempt these transactions from the provisions of the CEA. Every single one of our guys would have to be Morgan Stanley or Elon Musk, or maybe slightly less rich people than that, but certainly not. Me or a whole bunch of other guys. So I think that's where exemption was an option for us. Your Honor, I don't think that whether we chose our way into no action relief really matters at the end of the day. The question is, what does no action relief do? But to the extent it matters, it wasn't a viable choice for us.
Well, I mean, and I guess I will say, you just answered the question which I had responding to these two, because my concern was if what you're doing is taken away from you, aren't there other options? And so one, you're telling me, just can't do. You can't just register and continue to do it, because what you, people going, you're going on the line is registered.
That's right.
And then the second
option, under current commission law, that's
current commission law, they're not registered. And then the second option isn't available to you because your demographic is not going to meet that requirement.
The exact opposite of our demographic.
All right.
And so we're not submitting the academic purposes of this. That left us with no action relief, and you know, actually it's not something that we invented. Years prior to us, the Iowa electronic markets, which is still operating underway and hasn't been affected by this decision, opened their market for political events under the no action relief umbrella. So that's the so again, I don't think that it matters, it's a legal matter if we chose our way into this, but it really for us it was not a choice. And so
well, I'm not sure the answer to this, but was that to order the district court to rule or to order the district court to issue a preliminary injunction? What were you seeking in the district court amendment?
I would have taken either of those, Your Honor, but yes, we asked for either or, either asking the district court to issue a timely decision on our petition, on our motion for preliminary injunction, given the fact the clock was ticking on us, and you know, listen, it's not entirely up to us. We did have a compliance effort to undertake to close the market on February 15th, but you know, the lot of traders were fleeing and leaving stranded, a lot of traders who couldn't get out of their positions. So that's just and the district court, in our view, was watching that happen. So we were asking for a more prompt decision or an instruction to enter the preliminary injunction. Your Honors denied the writ of mandamus is otherwise taken care of by the injunction pending appeal. We think that was the right out, right, correct route, and the court had plenty of appellate jurisdiction. So you know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of the CFTC's arguments boil down to the fact that we should have you know, just kept pressing ahead in the face of this instruction on August 4th, kept going past February 15th, and if we had complaints about the level of explanation we were given or the arbitrariness of what happened, we could raise those in enforcement action as an affirmative defense. I do think
that would be for meaningless piece of paper.
What's that?
According to that, would be for meaningless.
Yes. That's right. I think that's a distinction that the Supreme Court and this court has taken. That, you know, when you have this is not a situation where the CFTC has said, you know, look, going backwards 5 years ago, we think you guys screwed up and we're going to bring enforcement action against you. We just wanted to know that. That's probably not final agency action. Here it's a prospective command. And if we ignore it, we're subjecting ourselves to monetary penalties. And what the Supreme Court says in Sackett and in Hawks, and what this court said in the data marketing partnership case, we don't have to wait for that. We don't have to take that risk, roll that dice in order to evaluate the arbitrariness of that structure.
If you operated outside the confines of the no action letter that's now been withdrawn, what is the nature of the penalties that you would face, or predicted would face?
I think the CFTC conveniently laid those out for us in both briefs below and here. On numerous occasions, the brief usually toward the end, they said, you know, listen, if you're outside the no action letter, you know, be prepared for a potential charge that you willfully violate the Commodity Exchange Act, which is a felony, and can be coordinated with the Department of Justice. Also, there are civil monetary penalties. And I think that's one of the key points of what this no action letter does. I mean, to the extent that no action letter is relevant, its revocation is relevant, it created a safe harbor for us. Not from everything, but from it limited our potential liability. And that's what Chief Justice Roberts said was important to us. It kept us away from monetary penalties just for operating the market during the period of time that was in place. And under those circumstances, if the agency wants to revoke that safe harbor, it has to explain its decision to do so.
Especially
advisory committee that was at issue in that Department of Partnership, this court's decision in August of last year.
What do you make of the point that this is not the agency itself? It's not the commission, nor is it a delegation of power. In fact, the regs say the law, and the regs also say it's not the commission, this is the DMO.
Yeah, I think
that's not a problem.
I don't think it's a problem. I think this is akin to reservations that you see in many agency decisions that say, look, we can change our mind later. Perhaps even the higher ups can change their mind later on this. That's true.
In the typical cases, there are some sort of delegation. I guess what I'm asking is, do you acknowledge that you are asking us to stretch the law at least a little bit to go from either commission actions or commission delegated actions to something that's neither, but obviously very writing and seemingly very efficient.
Well, there is a delegation here. It is 140.99. The commission will set it up in no action relief. And the commission sets it up as relief.
But it's saying that it's not the commission doing it, it's more the division.
It does, but it matters. It does, but it's also making clear that it can be relied on. And if not for this, then for what? I mean, what does that sentence mean? But beyond that, when we look to what this means, you know, perhaps the fact that it doesn't bind the commission says that, look, the commission can come in through some other normal operating way of doing things, like promulgating a rule with forward effect, through notice of comment rulemaking that says we're not doing political markets anymore, and that would wipe out the no action decision. But perhaps it's a reservation of that, but at least we have an opportunity to comment on that. Of course, saying it doesn't bind the commission is a little bit off point here for the commission, because the commission didn't come in and do this to us. It's the commission, right? It's the same fellow who issued the no action letter in 2014 that
came in and revoked it and threatened us with penalties if we didn't close at a precise minute in February 2023. But I think the thing I want Your Honor to focus on with regard to this question is the safe harbor that the no action relief letter created for us, at least against civil monetary penalties. So let's say the commission comes in and goes in a different direction. Now, one thing I think the commission would have a very hard time doing after this no action letter is saying, while it was in effect, before it changed direction, that you're on the hook for civil monetary penalties while that was happening. As a pragmatic matter, these enforcement actions arise from the division, go to the commission, get approved
There's a willfulness component, there's a willfulness component to some of the penalties. Right, you willfully violated things.
Yes, that's in the statute for criminal penalties.
You willfully violate something if you have a letter saying you need to operate within these parameters.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think what the commission could have done was, you know, forward instructed us to stop doing what we're doing, but to go back and provide us with put civil monetary penalties on us would have been, I think, legally impossible, and as a practical matter, it would have been extraordinarily unlikely, just given the way these enforcement actions work from division to commission, back to division to prosecute.
And again, your time has expired.
Yes,
thank
yes,
you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Kyle Drudin for the United States Commodity Futures Trading Commission. I would just like to correct a couple points that I think opposing counsel may have misstated about the record and our position. So for the start about Predictive being unregulated or not, it has at all times been unregulated. Predictive was instructed as much. Here I would refer you to the revocation of the no action letter. This is at record 257. The very last term that Predictive was supposed to adhere to in DMO's 2014 no action letter was a restriction on advertising. As part of that, they were supposed to prominently disclose that the platform is unregulated, experimental, and being operated for academic purpose. I don't think there's any ambiguity about that. To the question of what the effect of the iterative informal staff communication that DMO had with the university's representatives, I think that's a different question, but I don't think there's any question in the record that anyone understood, including Victoria University, which hasn't said otherwise, that they were either licensed or authorized or somehow in compliance with their registration and or exemption requirements. Congress sets those out, that's in the Commodity Exchange Act, and commission implementing regulations.
We're using this term unregulated. What does that mean?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in this context, it would mean falling under the jurisdiction of the CFTC in the Commodity Exchange Act and in accordance with the Commodity Exchange Act's terms. And here, I think the two ones we've identified are the requirement that entities seeking to offer event contracts like Predictit be registered or seek an exemption from registration. The two ways that Congress has set up to do that are DCM registration. So as you register yourself as the market, you subject yourselves to anti-manipulation standards, cybersecurity standards, reporting requirements, the normal prospective regulatory requirements that all CFTC regulated entities have to adhere to. Or if the commission determines in the public interest following a factual finding based on a sort of prescribed process that's set out in the statute of wellness is the Section 6C, Section 6C public interest exemption. If after that process it's determined by the commission that there's been a showing that would be in the public interest under the circumstances to exempt the particular entity here Predictit, they could have dispensed with that requirement. That hasn't happened either. There's been no delegation of that authority to be staff, and I want to be entirely clear that nothing in Rule 140.99A1, which is the exemption letter requirement, which is the only staff letter section that has any sort of delegated authority and binding effect on the commission. And I would note that the
I think opposing counsel makes the point, which seems like a reasonable one, that it's the very existence of the regulation that is the delegation.
Yes, Your Honor, but then I think you need to read what the regulation says. And so Regulation 149.9A1, A2, and A3 provide for three very different forms of letters. They're exemptive letters, there are informational letters, and there are no action letters, which of course are the ones relevant here. The exemptive letters provide for delegated authority and the explicit ability of staff under carefully prescribed circumstances to step in the commission's shoes and exempt certain transactions. I don't believe event market registration is one of them. Plaintiffs have never claimed that, and certainly DMO staff don't cite any authority for that position that that's what they were doing here. Informational letters, which simply use reliance language, are also defined as informal staff guidance about a broadly applicable statement of the law, similar to any form of informal staff guidance, like the data marketing partnership case. A Department of Labor informational letter is similar to that. And they provide that the public can rely on that, not just the person requesting the letter, but that it's also non-binding on the commission. So I think what the force of that reliance is, it would be the staff-specific adherence to that position going forward until such an information letter is revoked. Similarly, in the no action context, which is Rule 140.99A2, the relevant staff conduct is the refraining from making a recommendation of an enforcement action to the commission. So the extent that there's a reliance entrance, it's that while that letter is in effect, the staff will not make that recommendation that they said they would not until that letter is either withdrawn or revoked or something about it has changed. And
does the commission make enforcement actions without a recommendation of the division?
It can, Your Honor. Yes, they are delegated that authority.
Surely you're not saying that these no action letters are valueless.
No, Your Honor. That's correct.
Very powerful.
Yes, I think we are saying the opposite. They are a valuable form of what they are, which is a staff informal.
Which just stand to reason that the rescission of such is also an important, meaningful, powerful act.
It could be, but it's not legally powerful. And here I think this is the difference in what Bennett versus Spears
point. What would it be other than legally? You're the government, right?
I think what it is it's a reflection, again, like any form of informal staff guidance, of an expression of the relevant expert staff's opinion. In this case, because it's a staff level recommendation, I think that's critical, about what those staff, based on their experience and understanding of what the commission is likely to do in a particular circumstance. It's a reflection of that, but it's not binding on the commission.
It binds the staff, it binds the division not to recommend enforcement.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think under the Supreme Court's Franklin versus Massachusetts case, and as interpreted by the D.C. Circuit's Engler decision that we cite in our brief, staff level or subordinate recommendations are not the same as the consummation of the agency's decision-making process, and there are no legal consequences that are triggered here.
How can I square what you're saying right now with what the rescission or the withdrawal of the no-action letter says, where it says, at the end, in the second to last paragraph, to the extent that the university is operating any contract market et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of those related and remaining listed contracts and positions comprising all associated open interest in such market should be closed out and or liquidated no later than 11:59 p.m. Eastern on February 15th, 2023. If this is just a, you know, a recommendation, how am I supposed to understand, more importantly, how is Predicted supposed to understand that kind of, that's like setting a death sentence. That's what it sounds like.
No, with respect, Your Honor, I think we disagree with that. I think what plaintiffs want to do is read into that an or else condition, and understandably.
If there's not an or else, should be closed out and or liquidated?
Yes, Your Honor, but there's a difference between should and must again, and this is recognized by the D.C. Circuit.
You're saying this is just sort of a friendly suggestion?
I don't necessarily know if I would phrase it as a friendly. It's certainly a suggestion, however. And I think what staff would be empowered to do is, again, we're looking at Rule 140.9982 for the sole scope of their authority, and they could then make a recommendation. So I think at most what they're saying is, if you don't do this, we will recommend an enforcement action. I think to correct another point,
actually, this sounds like a license to bully.
A license to bully, Your Honor?
Bully. Yeah, I mean, in other words, you can issue these threatening letters. There's no judicial review.
Well, Your Honor,
I understand. I take it there's no argument that Mr. McGonigal is behaving in an ultra-virus fashion. You haven't fired him. He's acting under government authority.
That's correct, because he's never purported to do something like order a license or an authorization. Had he done so, I think that would be ultra-virus, as we said.
It's hortatory. It's not a government order. That's your theory.
Well,
I
think that is part of that language. There is no authority for him to order independent legal penalties. He doesn't prescribe any. There is also no, as I mentioned, there's not an offense for violating the terms of staff-created no-action conditions. That's not something you can be charged with.
Suppose I predicted decided to blow off this unfriendly suggestion from Mr. McGonigal, and an enforcement action then happened. Even if contracts going forward were even being operated within the terms of the no action letter, wouldn't all of a sudden they be subject to, the idea would be, well, now you're willfully doing it. We just told you to shut everything down. You kept doing it. It's willful. So criminal or civil penalties should follow from that.
Your Honor, I believe that would be evidence of willfulness to the extent that they were given advice and chose to ignore it or made representations that were not accurate.
I appreciate your candor. So it would be evidence of willfulness if they, after 11:59 p.m. Eastern on February 15th, 2023, continued to have to operate the market.
But Your Honor, if I may correct or further explain the evidence of willfulness, it's not that it's evidence of willfulness as much as it's evidence of what good faith measures they took to comply in an effort to perhaps mitigate damages or potential penalties. And I want to be clear, the Commission does not authorize an enforcement action. DMO has not said that it will actually make an enforcement recommendation here.
I want to ask you just about that, because let's assume DMO did recommend enforcement action.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who makes the decision about whether or not enforcement action would be taken?
The Commission acting as a multi-member body, so it would be a majority vote.
So DMO would make a recommendation. The Commission could decide to take enforcement action or not.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so I know the obvious next question is, so how often is it that the Commission disagrees with what DMO recommends?
I'm not aware of that, and it's not on the record. It's not part of the amended complaint allegations either. I don't believe Predict-It was relying on some sort of...
But at the step where... CTFC, and I'm getting these initials, CTFC decides to take enforcement action, then they get notice and some opportunity to be heard in connection with that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And so I think this is the longstanding Ewing doctrine that plaintiffs and to the extent we didn't explain it clearly, we apologize. But I think it's a longstanding principle of administrative law that when you're challenging what are charging decisions, you don't file a declaratory action and then seek an injunction saying, please, you cannot charge me. You take the complaint and then you file affirmative defenses.
I don't understand that that's what they're doing at all. What they're doing is they were relying on the no action letter, as the regulation says they may do, and now the no action letter has been withdrawn without explanation. So they're all those reliance interests, which they say are irreparable, have now been evaporated, right?
Your Honor, to the extent there was a reliance interest, it was solely to the extent under 140.99A2 that the DMO staff would not make an affirmative enforcement.
But the fact that the regulation says only the beneficiary may rely upon the no action letter suggests that the no action letter has value to the beneficiary.
Yes, Your Honor. I imagine it would be valuable to know that you are not going to have an enforcement recommendation made against you by one particular part of the agency. But notably, it's not binding on the commission, as we've discussed, but it's also not binding on the other divisions, including the Division of Enforcement. So were the Division of Enforcement to receive a complaint to make a recommendation, regardless of what DMO had said in the no action letter?
Confirm, there is no appeal from the withdrawal of the no action letter.
There's no appeal in the sense that you cannot challenge the terms of the withdrawal letter itself, but there is further process in the commission's decision-making process in that the commission still has to authorize an enforcement action, as Judge Graves noted.
There's no one else in the CFTC I can go to say, oh, please, don't withdraw my no action letter, right?
The issuing staff would be who you would go to. That's correct, Your Honor.
You could go back to McGonigal, right? But nobody else.
Yes, the Division of Market Oversight, who was the only person bound by this letter and issued it, would be the person who would either rescind or re-rescind, as the case may be.
Okay.
Whoever is currently occupying that role, yes, Your Honor.
Can you help me out with sounds to me like a paradox in your position, but I want to give you the opportunity to explain away why I'm wrong. On the one hand, the document means nothing. and you say that because that's your basis for saying you can't sue to protect your right to go to the market. So for now, document means nothing. But if you go to market, then you're going to be punished based on this document. So that, you know, more penalties, willfulness, all that. So the document does mean something after all. That's the catch-22 that I see you're essentially posing to the market here.
No, Your Honor, I think neither parts of that is what we're saying. I think what we're saying is there's no safe harbor. So if you look at the Hawks case, right, that was a jurisdictional determination by the Army Corps, and final jurisdictional determinations of the Army Corps bind both the U.S. Army Corps and the EPA from a five-year period starting enforcement action, as the Supreme Court noted. It doubles your potential monetary penalties, and it prevents you from getting other permits necessary for whatever project it is you want to do under the Clean Water Act. There's nothing of that sort here. To the extent that someone in Predictit's situation sought informal staff guidance here in the form of a no-action letter, but it could equally have been an informational letter, I think that may be evidence of good faith effort to try to comply or at least minimize potential responsibility. Now, were it the case that those representations were false, obviously, I think that would be a different question. So the question, I think, is a factual one. Under the circumstances, what would the effort of having tried to secure, abide by the no action letter meant, and in terms of sort of a damages good faith situation, but there's nothing that triggers that the same way that there's a formal safe harbor for either the jurisdictional determination by Army Corps I mentioned, or in the Sackett case, an EPA compliance order that imposes similarly permanent limitations sort of formally triggered enhanced penalties.
This document means something, clearly. The consequences flow from this rescission document. Your point is just following the text of the APA, they just can't do anything about it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think this document is valuable the same way other informal staff guidance is valuable. I think the document means what it says. I think Rule 149.9A2 means what it says. I think the APA means what it says. And so if you take all those things together, there is not the sort of licensing authority, which really is the contradiction in plaintiff's position, that they received an affirmative license that Congress never authorized, the commission never delegated, and staff never purported to give them. I think that's the issue.
You don't think a no-action letter that they're induced to rely on under the regs is, what's the language from the APA, a form of permission?
No, Your Honor, we don't. I think for the reason given in the shared...
You see why it would feel like that to many people.
I can understand how broadly the APA defines its terms, but there has to be a...
And not just that, I mean... Just reading the letter, I mean, both the original letter and the second one, it looks like you're saying you can do this, And as it turns out, you can't do this because you violated various rules.
Well, I don't think you get that
from permission granted, permission denied.
I think you don't get that from reading the letter, Your Honor. So if you look at the letter, the sole cherry-picked word that plaintiffs use, it comes from the introduction, like the second paragraph that says, you are hereby allowed, or you are requesting permission, summarizing Victoria University's position that they are seeking permission to operate under the CEA. But then you jump ahead to the actual relief provision, which
permit
is
the operation of a nonprofit electronic market.
Yes, which is characterizing their position. It's not safe. But then you go to the sort of operative provision of the relief letter, which is at pages 5 and 6. Under the heading scope of DMO relief, there's nothing like that in there. It does not say you are authorized. It does not say you are licensed. It does not say you are permitted. What it says is, consequently, DMO will not make a recommendation based on your representations. And I would note also that unlike the formal DCM registration or Section 4C public interest exemption framework, there was no fact-finding done here. All of this was based on the university's representations, which I think further cements the lack of any misunderstanding that the university might have had that they were granted a license.
Well, there's certainly some fact-finding done in the withdrawal of the no-action letter. In the first sentence of the next to last paragraph, it says, the university has not operated its market in compliance with the terms of letter 14-130. With no explanation of why, and then it goes on to say, as a result, letter 14-130 is hereby withdrawn. Back to the original no action letter, it is described as the scope of no action relief provided by DMO. What is relief mean in that context?
Absolutely. Again, Your Honor, it's what's provided for in Rule 149.982. It's that the staff will not make an enforcement recommendation while that letter is still out there, which is what happened here. And so I think according to, the plain language of Rule 149.982, the plain language of that letter, there's nothing equivalent to a license. And I would note, to Your Honor's question of whether or not it's another form of permission, even if it were considered agency action, it's not final agency action because it doesn't meet the Bennett prongs. So I don't think our argument necessarily hinges on whether or not this qualifies as another form of permission or relief of some sort. It really is that it's not the consummation of the commission's decision-making process, because the commission hasn't reached an enforcement determination, and it's not something from which rights or obligations are determined.
But we know from the rescission letter that the department has found that Predicted is not being operated in under the terms of the no-action letter. We know that.
Yes, Your Honor, that is DMO's position, which I would also add is equally non-binding on the commission. And to the point that we don't yet have an administrative record, and I know plaintiffs have harped on this, that we have not yet offered a merits defense, I think the reason for that is, given the procedural posture, we're still at the threshold of this litigation. The administrative record hasn't been produced. We're not at the summary judgment phase, so we don't know the full extent of this. As plaintiffs mentioned, there was a number of communications not reflected in these letters, although referenced. So there were, in the 2014 no action letter, DMO notes that some of the university's representations were made over phone calls and emails and meetings rather than just in the formal letters that were attached to the amended complaint. So we know that there were additional communications here. And I would note specifically that as early as 2014, and this is at record 155, that DMO's chief counsel's office was in correspondence with the university's then counsel at Arnold and Porter, raising questions about Predicted's compliance with what they characterize as indiscriminate advertising and out-of-scope contracts, authorizing people to essentially bet on the number of Ebola cases that would happen in the United States. And that's not something that we've disclosed. That was an attachment to their preliminary injunction motion. So I would say, Your Honor, to the extent there's fact-finding and to the extent that the university, which is not here to speak for itself, may have been aware of these reasons, that's not yet in the record.
Thank you,
Counselor.
Your time is expired.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start with the difference between should and must. This is two letters of one word that is a very dangerous parse when you're an entity that's under the gun, that if you blow through the 11:59 p.m. deadline, you're subject to penalties and potentially criminal prosecution. I don't think this is the situation when the government, with all its power, is writing you the letter that we need to be parsing the mood of a verb. I don't think that if that's the defense of the CFTC, I don't think it's one that holds water. I want to talk about this debate about whether we're regulated or not. Certainly here, the CFTC has attempted to set rules for us in the no action letter. There are at least 8 of them. They are repeated in the letter revoking our no action relief and ordering us to close. And they are detailed down to the amount of money that can be invested and the number of investors that can be in a particular contract. In any event, this is a situation about whether we're about to be regulated or not through civil penalties. And it boils down to a discussion about whether a policy that is born from abstaining from enforcement can be revoked without explanation. That might have been a valid argument 3 years ago. I don't think it is good law anymore. After the Supreme Court's decision in Department of Homeland Security versus Board of Regents, after this court's decision in Wages versus White Lion, even a policy that starts its life as a forbearance for enforcement in a discretionary manner, when reliance interests build up around it, and reliance is what the regulation contemplates and what actually happened here, it has to be explained on the way out, and that did not occur here. And I think that's an important point. If what does reliance mean in 140.99 under the CFTC's view? It must have a legal significance of some sort, and it did occur here. I mean, my clients would have been perfectly happy to keep their money in their pocket if the CFTC had said no in 2014, no, you can't start this market. Instead, they plowed millions of dollars into setting it up. The traders plowed millions more into the investments. They relied on the CFTC saying that it would be allowed to go forward. On the safe harbor point, Hawks tells us that if a policy creates a safe harbor, it needs to be explained when it's revoked, and it needs to be explained coming in. It also says that the safe harbor doesn't have to be complete. It just has to limit our potential liability. And in this case, that certainly happened here. It provided us protection from at least the most common form of enforcement action, which is one that is recommended by the divisions of the commission. It protected us with almost absolute protection against a claim of willful violations of the CEA. And it provided us with effective protection against civil money penalties for just running this market while the no action letter was in place. And what Hawks says is that when that safe harbor is created, it is a final agency action. It needs to be explained on the way in and on the way out. And on the way out, it wasn't explained. I want to also turn to Judge Ho to the license issue that we did not talk about at the beginning of this argument, but that you brought up with CFTC counsel. I think this absolutely is another form of permission under 551.8 of the Administrative Procedure Act and the definition of license. Oddly enough, that section goes through what license could be. It could be registration. It could be exemption from a requirement, or it could be any other form of permission. And I think if you turn to 145, the first sentences of the no action letter, the agency knows that this is allowing the market to be set up. And in that regard, we need to distinguish all no action letters from this no action letter. Your normal no action letter, Your Honors, is concerns an incremental feature of business conduct for an ongoing business. This no action letter allowed us to set up a business in the first place. And again, if they had said no, the money would still be in our pockets. We would have been disappointed, but these reliance interests would not have built up. This is a super no action letter. It's not upending the entire process. And the concerns that the CFTC's raised about the systemic issues in the administrative state should not be a concern to this court. If your honors have any further questions, I see my time has expired.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, your honors.
We'll take this matter under advisement, and we are adjourned.